Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does a photographer combine art and journalism to capture the beauties, hardships, and shared experiences of people living in vastly different ways around the world? Photographer Annie Griffiths was one of the first women to shoot for National Geographic magazine, and that first assignment came almost by accident when the magazine called her at Minnesota's Worthington Daily Globe and asked whether she could send some pictures of a severe hailstorm that had just hit. Since then, she's worked around the world for National Geographic and other publications, with a growing emphasis in recent years on the ways that the lives of women are affected by climate change. Griffiths is also the author of the 2008 memoir, A Camera, Two Kids, and a Camel. She's in town to speak tonight at the Brinker International Forum, which takes place at 8 at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. Annie, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So you actually went to school thinking you'd be a writer.
I did. Yeah, I absolutely did. In fact, my mother, I think, still has not quite forgiven me. It was really funny. A few years ago, I told her I was working on a story for, I can't remember which magazine, and she heard the word story, and she said, "Oh, honey, I'm so glad you're writing again." I said, "No, Mom, actually, I'm taking the pictures."
Do you see a relationship between writing and taking photographs?
Yes, and it's in the word stories. Mm-hmm. I think that that's what I have always been drawn to. And when I tripped over a camera in my junior year of college, I just found a way to tell stories differently. But that's what it's about.
Did you instantly know, I'm really good at this?
No. It was much more like falling in love. Mm-hmm. I just loved it. It just lit a fire inside me that was new to me. It was something I had never considered doing as a profession. And I took the photo course quite by accident and got in by accident because someone else didn't show up. So I'm an accidental photographer.
So expand on this story that I told a little of in the introduction, because people go their entire careers, very distinguished photographers, just dreaming of someday getting an assignment for National Geographic. You were 25?
Well, when I got the call, I was 23.
Wow.
By 25, I was working there full time. Mm-hmm. But yes, one of those happy accidents where I was working at this wonderful, it was really a wonderful little regional daily with a great photo history, which is why the director of photography knew about the newspaper. And when he saw that there'd been this severe hailstorm and knew that one of his stories needed a great hail damage picture, he literally called the darkroom and I was the one who answered the phone.
Wow. Do you believe in fate? What's your sense of that?
You know, I think what I believe in is that if we follow our passion and if we work really hard, then we're prepared when and if a lucky break comes our way. And that certainly happened to me. It wasn't until about a year and a half later that I went back to National Geographic with an actual proposal and a portfolio. But I never would have had the courage to do that had I not, received that phone call and gotten one little image published.
So you've been all over the world now, but you, as a kid, you didn't travel a lot?
I didn't travel at all. No, I grew up in Minnesota, and my family didn't have the means to travel. But I have a mother who lived to travel and dreamed of traveling, and she kind of raised all of us saying, if any of you get married before you're 30, I'll shave your heads. Get out there and see the world. And most of us did.
Mm-hmm. Most of you. How many kids in your family?
There are 4 kids in my family. My older brother became an airline pilot and, of course, traveled extensively. Mm-hmm. I traveled extensively. My sister hasn't traveled quite as much, but she speaks 6 languages.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was only the caboose, my brother Bobby, who got his first passport a couple of years ago and now is excited about traveling.
What did it take for you to learn, not having done it with your parents as a kid, to be a good traveler? And it's different to travel for vacation than it must be to go for work and to really have to hit the ground running.
Oh, it's completely different. But I have a hard time traveling without some kind of a project because, when you're traveling for work, you're traveling with your full-on curiosity. Mm-hmm. You're not traveling to relax. You're certainly traveling to learn, but you want to know more. You're, as a journalist, you're constantly on the hunt for insight and a situation that will reveal culture or reveal a particular problem that you're trying to illustrate. And you have, you know, the camera is your passport to meet people and say, can I go home with you? Mm-hmm. So when I travel and I don't have that excuse, I sometimes get a little antsy because I want to get behind the scenes. You know, I don't want to go to the ballet. I want to be backstage. And, you know, so I have this incredible privilege of going in depth behind the scenes of all kinds of things. Even just being in someone's kitchen with them is a huge privilege.
I feel the same way in some ways about this job because I don't go home with anyone, but mm-hmm. I get to ask people the things that everybody wonders about, but mm-hmm. somehow it seems impolite in a regular conversation.
Somehow, yeah.
Is it hard to say to somebody, can I go home with you? Especially people who have never had an internationally renowned photographer follow them home.
You know, the interesting thing is most of the people I want to go and spend time with have never heard of National Geographic. Mm. Often I'm kind of an aberration because I'm a Caucasian woman, unchaperoned, and it's odd in many places that women travel like that and that women work like that. But it's astonishing to me how quickly people welcome me into their lives. And I try to give back while I'm with them and make them happy that they met me and happy that they had this encounter.
Obviously, I know you're respectful of sort of local cultural sensitivities about what is appropriate attire for a woman. But do you try to dress like a local? Do you dress like yourself, but maybe with a scarf on or something?
I try to dress very practically, and very respectfully. But, you know, I tell this funny story about when I was in Pakistan a few years ago and I was dressed modestly. I was in an extremely remote part of Pakistan and we traveled for hours off road.
It's rough country.
Rough country, yep. And I got to this tiny little village and all the women there were in silk. You know, mm-hmm. they were very poor, but they were dressed the way they dress in India. And it was 120 degrees. And I had on these awful khaki pants and this baggy shirt and this dreadful scarf. And I was pink from being hot, you know, and sweaty. And we were hiding from the sun in this shelter. And pretty soon I could tell the women were they were laughing. And I could, mm-hmm. pretty soon I could tell they were talking about me. And I said to my guide, okay, what's going on? And she goes, oh, nothing. I said, no, come on, tell me. And she said, they want to know if you're a man or a woman. And I literally grabbed my breasts and said, I'm a woman. And then I pulled out a picture of my children. And then they really started laughing. And I found out later it's because they were amazed any man would have me. So, you know, you travel with a sense of humor. And sometimes you don't try to fit in, but you try to be respectful. But then at the same time, open to how ridiculous you can sound and look and be as you're trying to pantomime a relationship with people.
To the extent it's possible, are you talking or gesturing with the people that you're shooting as you're shooting them, or do you try to sort of become a ghost in the room?
No, I don't try to become a ghost. I try to be as non-intimidating as I possibly can be. You know, it's interesting. I just, even my posture, the way I am with people, I don't even own a camera vest and mm-hmm. I don't even carry a camera bag. I just use an old backpack and I use minimal equipment and try to be non-threatening, really. And it's astonishing how quickly people will just go back to their daily lives and let me be with them. You know, I really look them in the eye. I'm very affectionate. I'm very warm with people. And it works.
I'm guessing you shoot all digital now.
I do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you turn off the sound so that people don't hear every time the shutter clicks?
No. I don't worry about that. But I am very aware that rapid fire shooting is intimidating. Mm-hmm. So I try to be sort of quiet and strategic with the camera, but I'm interacting with the people when it's appropriate, and I'm putting the camera away when it's appropriate too.
Do kids everywhere want to see themselves in the LCD monitor instantly?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And And you kind of get that out of the way. Mm-hmm. Back in the film days, I would sometimes have an empty camera when I'd come to a village so that all the kids could say, you know, take my picture, take my picture, take my picture. And I would take lots and lots of pictures with no film in the camera. Mm-hmm. Just until, because children just want to make sure that they've got your attention for a little bit, and then they're bored with you quite quickly. Mm-hmm. Now, though, you know, they want to see it in the back of the camera, so we play with that, and I often let them take a few pictures. But again, they get bored fairly quickly and go back to being a kid.
So when you're in places that are really divided according to gender, mm-hmm. how do the guys feel about you, an American woman, doing this job, which is historically a male-dominated profession?
It's interesting. In gender-separate societies, I find that the man, you have to be very careful that you're not dishonoring someone mm-hmm. or breaking some kind of a rule. You know, sometimes there's someone who's the head of a village or of the family who needs a little bit of attention, but they're not terribly interested in women usually. Mm-hmm. Whether I'm a photographer or not. So I try to just have my antenna up and get some advice on what's appropriate. But I think it's a huge advantage being a woman photographer, because there are lots and lots of men covering the men's side of things in gender-separate societies, and there aren't all that many women covering the women's side. So I have more material to work with. And I really like women. And I, you know, what I love to show is that even though Westerners tend to judge gender separate societies, they're all over the place. And most of the women are very happy and are loved, and they just form their alliances with their sisters and their in-laws and their, you know, their daughters and the women that they're with. And while the guys are off doing their thing, the women have a very joyful sisterhood, as the guys do with their buddies. Now, having said that, women around the world are saddled with far too much of the labor and the responsibility, and I'm very concerned and focused on that with my nonprofit, because you know, women carry huge, huge burdens in this world, and just need a little bit of help.
I went on your website, which for people who haven't seen it, it's AnnieGriffithsBelt.com. It's amazing. Loved many of the pictures. The one that made me cry was a really happy picture, actually. And it was some kids in Cambodia, and they've just put in a well.
Yes.
And these kids are so happy, and it's a joyful picture. Mm-hmm. But it's devastating because it reminds you that not every child in the world or their parents can count on safe, clean, available water.
No, in fact, a huge, huge part of the world is without safe, clean, available water. And women are the ones who are expected to haul it, women and girls, and as well as haul the wood to light their fires. And as environments change and climate changes, women are impacted at a far greater rate than men are, because they're, you know, carrying water, carrying their children, caring for their parents.
Annie Griffiths is my guest. She's a photographer who shoots for National Geographic and other publications, and she's the author of the 2008 memoir, A Camera, Two Kids, and a Camel. More about that in a minute. She's in town to speak tonight at the Brinker International Forum at the AT&T Performing Arts Center at 8 o'clock. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is photographer Annie Griffiths. She's in town to speak tonight at the Brinker International Forum. That's at 8 o'clock at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. You can find more information at attpec.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So for years, you have this amazing peripatetic career, and then you're 36, and suddenly your job title expands to include mother.
Yes. Yeah. So, wonderfully so.
So unlike maybe everybody else, you decided you're just going to keep going.
Exactly. Well, I felt so fortunate to suddenly be able to be a mom. And I had worked for Geographic for a decade at that time. So I thought, well, I'll just take it 1 year at a time and see how it goes. So Lily, my oldest, actually was in 13 countries in utero. She traveled. Huh. You know, I started it right off the bat while I was still carrying the kids, and then started traveling with them. I was, you know, I certainly had to make some concessions in terms of trying to propose projects that were compatible with my kids and not taking them certainly any place where they were at risk or or miserable. Yeah. But as long as I kept my dance card very full with those kinds of projects, it worked beautifully.
Well, you mentioned earlier, I guess for a photographer, it sounds like you travel very light with just a backpack. I don't know any mother of small children who can travel light. Was that kind of an art?
It is an art, but but I am a flight attendant's worst nightmare because, you know, I used to step on the plane with camera gear and strollers and kids and bottles and all of it.
These days that would be $900 extra dollars.
Yeah. Well, even so, I kept it light. I mean, in there, you know, if kids are comfortable and busy, they usually behave beautifully. And mine did. And there was some bribery involved as well. You know, every time they got on a new vehicle and had their seatbelt fastened, they got a good traveler reward, which was usually something to do in the next leg of the journey. So my daughter, who checks into these things immediately and always did, from about age three, when she'd find out we were going somewhere, she'd ask how many vehicles we'd be in. You know? Because she figured that it was that many prizes. So once they got on the airplane and buckled their seatbelt, they got something. If we got on a train and they were seated and buckled in, they got something, and it worked.
What kinds of rules did you have for them? I guess they weren't always with you on the shoot itself.
Rarely on the shoot, yeah.
But when they came along, what did you talk about beforehand in terms of what they'd be expected to do and not do?
Well, it was a way of life they knew so well. I didn't really have to explain many things because from the time they were infants, they were doing it. But they certainly, you know, my kids were raised with excellent manners. They were raised to entertain themselves really quite well and to know that when I was working, I was working, and when I wasn't working, I was all theirs. They didn't come on shoots very often, especially when they were little, because, you know, a child who sees his or her mother wants his or her mother.
Yeah.
It's just cruel to say, no, you can't bother me. While so I always had a babysitter, a nanny along, and it worked better than I could have dreamed. It really did. And it was expensive to do it that way, but I found ways to cover those expenses and keep them as low as possible. And it was so important to me to have my kids with me that was the priority.
When you look back on pictures that you've taken from the times when your kids were little, whether or not they were with you on the shoot, do you think, oh, that's when Lily knocked out her first tooth? Or I'm wondering if you make those associations in your head.
I make the associations primarily in the places we traveled, especially when they were very young, and the community of friends we built. And we traveled for about 5 years in the Middle East, and that's my children and our family's strongest, you know, chunk of time on the road, because the kids were so happy and, you know, they were learning to milk goats and scramble over rocks. And the Arab culture is so welcoming and so family oriented that every adult is looking after every child. And my kids were hugely popular because they had light colored hair. And just watching them navigate lack of language and different realities and ride donkeys and camels. And it was wonderful. It was really wonderful.
So for every time that you celebrate the idea that you're somewhere that maybe a male photographer wouldn't be welcomed, there's also the flip side that you're probably not getting in somewhere that a male photographer might go. Is that did you spend any time being frustrated at that?
Not very much time. I think it's the way I see the world. You know, there are advantages to being short and there are advantages to being tall. And so I must say that had I had a choice, I would have chosen to be a woman photographer because I really think I had advantages in ways that men can't. Maybe that's just because my memories are so wonderful, but I really was able to navigate my way into situations that it would have been, I was less threatening always, not just in the company of women. And I think that's a huge advantage when you're trying to disappear and let reality happen in front of the camera.
I have to imagine some of that's about who you are as an individual, though, as much as the fact that you happen to be a woman.
Oh, certainly. I mean, there are certainly each photographer has a different way of working, has a different personality, and my way of working is very personal. And I love to be in intimate situations and record that intimacy. And it means you have to be very trusting and open yourself to get that close to people's lives.
Is it always your goal that a photograph will make sense even if there's no written information next to it?
Oh, that a photograph can stand alone?
Yeah.
I guess the way I would put it is at National Geographic in particular, our magazine is photo-driven, but our job really is to take photographs that are so compelling that it'll make the reader want to read the caption.
Mm-hmm.
And that the captions are so beautifully written in our magazine that they lead people into the story. So it's a really yes, I love it when my photographs just stand alone, and you know, and all of our egos are happy when it just, you know, would hang on a wall and be perfect. But the job really is to have the photographs work together to lead the reader through a story that's important. And so I'm always grateful for how talented the writing staff is at Geographic, and how they write these very compelling captions that then take us into the bigger story.
Do you think the art versus journalism question for a photographer is a false dichotomy?
Yes. I mean, I guess you could do it with writing also. You know, is journalism artistic writing? Well, yes, if it's well done, it really is. And I think the same is true with photographs. And it's really unimportant to me in an interesting way. I want my photography to be as powerful as possible. But I'm not really concerned in terms of how someone describes it. To me, I'm doing a job, and especially as time goes on, I want my work to be useful as well as beautiful. That's really important to me, that my photographs are used in a million different ways to educate, to enlighten, to encourage people to get involved, to travel, to see things in a different way, to understand.
What happens to the photographs that aren't selected for the magazine? I guess they're your property?
They are, and they're my constant nightmare.
You have 15 backed up hard drives, or how does that work?
Well, there's that, and then there are the 300,000 that haven't been scanned yet. I think I'm looking into my dotage. I'll be trying to catch up with all the work that's never been digitized. And so, you know, it's a mixed blessing having all that work. And I think that's true with most photographers. And you just try to take really good care of the best chickens in the coop. And then as you can, you also go through and try to find additional material that, you know, for some reason or another wasn't selected.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is National Geographic photographer Annie Griffiths. Let's go on the phones now to Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Is it Annie Griffith?
Yes.
Well, we've all seen the now iconic photograph of the Afghan woman with the green eyes peering out, the young woman peering out from beneath, they call them saris over there. I don't know what they call them.
Yes.
But anyway, that was shot on Kodachrome, and so you kind of answered my question as I was listening here. Sounds like you do shoot a lot of film as opposed to digital.
No, actually, the whole industry has gone digital, so there aren't many photographers shooting film anymore, and there's nobody shooting Kodachrome anymore because last week was the closing of the very last Kodachrome lab. I think it was in Kansas.
How is the did you develop your own pictures when you were shooting on film?
I did at the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Black and white is really fun and easy to develop. It too is not found very often anymore at newspapers and things. But it's a great loss because I think having that kind of hands-on association with film really helps you understand the whole emulsion and the whole process. And it's magic. It's absolute magic to watch a picture come up either on film or in the tray. At Geographic, no. The photographers have never handled their own film. Everything went to a special lab. And we worked very closely, especially with Kodak, to get really fresh processing and fresh film in certain batches. And it was all handled in that way.
I guess when you have a digital photograph, if you're color correcting something, do you have to be really careful not to color enhance something?
Yes. I mean, one of the saddest things about digital now is that a lot of people have lost their innocence in terms of believing photographs, mm-hmm. because Photoshop has become a verb now. So when people see a really excellent picture, almost immediately a lot of people say, well, I guess they Photoshopped it. And that's really a sad loss because journalists and many, many photographers do not alter images. You know, what we do in Photoshop is not just like what we did in the darkroom, which mm-hmm. is, you know, you process it and you give it a little contrast and you might dodge or burn a little, but you don't put the Eiffel Tower in Bahrain.
Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right. And there have always been ways that people could be dishonest with photographs. And I really, I'm really proud of my colleagues and of my industry in that we are really committed to not altering reality. And when it has happened, the photographers who've done it have been very publicly cast out.
What kind of relationship do you have with a writer on a story? Because sometimes you're not even in the same location at the same time. Is that right?
Right. I think that there's an assumption that either the writer writes the piece and directs the photographer, or the photographer shoots the piece and directs the writer. And Geographic is very much a democracy. You know, it's just great because both the photographer and the writer are treated as absolute experts on the subject and are very much a part of the whole process, whether they ever meet or not. I mean, there have been stories where I didn't meet the writer, but we share ideas. There was a story where I married the writer. So, you know, it can be anyway, as long as there's good, clear communication. And then we're working with editors, of course, who supervise that.
So how did climate change start to be something that you really wanted to not dedicate all of your work to, but pay a lot of attention to?
Well, it's interesting. I really have been concerned about the environment for a very long time. A few years ago, Barbara Kingsolver and I did a book called Last Stand, America's Virgin Lands. And we did that really to remind Americans that we, too, are running out of wilderness mm-hmm. and that we have an obligation to protect it, the last 1%, to protect it for future generations. And it was a beautiful book and incredibly beautifully written. And then after that, because I was just by myself, I was doing a lot of aid work around the world, I started really observing how many people, and especially how women and girls were impacted by how climates changed in different parts of the world. Because if it was a drought, it was the women and girls who had to search further and further for water or fuel.
What are the men doing while this is taking place, by the way?
This is a very good question. I think
water's heavy.
The men are not carrying it, I promise you that. The women are carrying it, and sometimes they're carrying it for 10 and 11 hours a day. Mm. And their daughters are too, which means their daughters don't go to school, which means their daughters marry earlier and have more children. And I mean, it's this domino thing happens. And it's so reversible. It's so easy to empower women. And that's why I started my nonprofit, which is Ripple Effect Images. And it's a collective of women photographers, mostly women photographers. We have one wonderful, lonely guy who's a fantastic filmmaker. And we cover the programs that empower women because they don't want to be victims. You know, they just want a little bit of help so that they can take over and make their lives and the lives of their children and their families and their sisters and their communities better. So, and in observing this for about 15 years, I realized that that's the very best investment out there, is to invest in the programs that empower women, because they will pay it forward at about 3 times the rate that men will to their communities. And so recently we covered, for instance, a tree planting program in Kenya where the women have planted 50 million trees.
Oh, my goodness.
And they get carbon credits for them, and they have built schools, and their girls are going to school, and their, you know, trees provide shelter, they provide water, they provide fuel, they provide air for the rest of us to breathe.
Annie Griffiths is my guest. She's a photographer for National Geographic and author of the 2008 memoir, A Camera, Two Kids, and a Camel. She'll be speaking tonight to the Brinker International Forum at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is National Geographic photographer Annie Griffiths. You can find examples of her work online at anniegriffithsbelt.com. She's in town to speak tonight at the Brinker International Forum, which takes place at 8 o'clock at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Annie, you were talking about wanting to photograph efforts that are working. We hear often about USAID giving billions of dollars that turns out not to be that effective. What is working to help women in the developing world?
Well, I think recognizing them as the powerful people that they are, mm-hmm. I think aid that goes directly to women, that isn't going through layers and layers of bureaucratic stuff. I think really it isn't throwing tons and tons of money at a small group of women. It's much more, spreading small amounts of money strategically and training women. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about necessarily sending them to college. I'm talking about just training them on drip irrigation, on better farming practices, on gathering seeds and replanting, on how to dig a bore well, how to build a sand dam, things that will make their lives so much easier. And believe me, when they find a solution, you know, it's like a dog with a bone. They will share that information with other women, with other villages, with other communities. It's like it's the ripple effect, which is why I named my nonprofit Ripple Effect Images. Women just do that, and they train each other. So I think it's taking a really thoughtful look at women on the community level, and letting them begin that ripple that will then go out and affect, I mean, towns, villages, cities, and what comes from that then, of course, is when you empower women so that they don't have to spend 8, 9, 10 hours a day hauling water, mm-hmm. their daughters will go to school, and their daughters will then be empowered and gain confidence to go forward and maybe learn. I know I met a woman recently at the TED Women's Conference, and her father raised beans in an area of great malnutrition, and he raised his kids saying, if you eat beans every day, you'll be healthy. He just knew that. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, it was protein.
Yeah.
And she has gone, I know she grew up in a very poor farming community, but on her own, she started playing with beans and figuring out different strains of beans. And then she got a little bit of an education, and she learned. And now she has led huge numbers of communities in battling malnutrition by growing beans instead of just corn or just rice, things that fill your belly but you know, lack the nutrients that every child needs.
I'm curious about this. We've done a lot on this show about the potential of microfinance. Mm-hmm. Lately, we've heard reports that at least in some parts of the world, the for-profit side of the microfinance industry has been subject to some abusive practices. I think the mm-hmm. report that I heard was about India.
Yes.
Talk about how to sort of ensure that we get that right and make sure that it does have potential, but make sure that it doesn't sort of slide the wrong direction.
Well, I think the reality, there was a terrible scandal in India where, you know, some people lost the plot on microfinance. And as happened in our country, people were overpromised and naively took loans that they couldn't possibly repay. It's not a problem of microfinance. It's a problem of there are always thieves among us who will take advantage of certain programs. I think it's very much the exception, not the rule. And I think microfinance has been unbelievably successful in changing women's lives. So I have mixed feelings about it. I'm really glad that they're going to nail these people who were abusing poor people. But I also don't want it to cast a long shadow on microfinance, because it's been absolutely one of the greatest things that has happened in terms of empowering poor women.
I want to switch gears here just a little bit and talk about the fact that we've spoken a great deal about your work photographing people mm-hmm. in these really intimate situations. You've also done some really stunning nature work. And looking at the two kinds of pictures, it would seem like just almost a different form.
It is. I mean, maybe I have a short attention span. I love to try different things. And National Geographic really wants us to bring back a sense of place, even in a story that's primarily cultural or scientific or whatever. We really promise our readers that we'll give them a sense of what a place really feels like and looks like. And so I've been fortunate enough to dabble in wildlife photography and do quite a bit of landscape work. And I love it. To me, it's almost like being a writer who also dabbles in poetry. Mm-hmm. You know, you get, I think it keeps you sharp. It informs your other work, and I love doing it. The love of my life, the core work that I care about is intimate cultural photography, especially with women. But I welcome the chance to take that camera and do something all new, and I've been lucky enough to do it.
It looks like you also really like to get up in an airplane and see what's down below you.
Yeah, you know, I like to get up in just about anything. I was talking to my friend Bobby today about hot air ballooning in Turkey, because I want him to do it when he's there. But I you know, I'm in ultralights and I'm on elephants and camels and anything that, you know, transportation to me to get a different view of photography is thrilling. It's exhilarating.
Do you ever have you had to sort of get tough in a dangerous situation, or is there a side of you that we haven't revealed so far today?
What an interesting question. Yes, I mean, I don't particularly like getting tough, but I have been in situations where I had to get very tough very quickly. I mean, actually, not once but twice in light aircraft. I was up with a pilot who made a very serious error, and I had to force the pilot to land, not on any kind of a runway, once on a beach and once just on the desert. And I had to get real tough real fast because we would die. And every once in a while, you have to be quite firm with the people you're working with because you know what you're trying to get. And sometimes you're working – I'm talking about guides or I don't use interpreters a lot, but people who are hired to help you work. And sometimes they have a separate agenda or, in gender-separate societies, they may not understand why I'm committed to working in a – about, you know, telling certain stories and being in certain places.
So is it like, why take pictures of this woman grinding grain? Look what I'm doing over here? That kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it can be. It can be. Or something more complicated than that.
Yeah. You know?
But I normally know. Normally, you know, it's this incredibly interesting collaboration. And it's almost like choreography in that often I don't have the gift of language in common, and so I have to listen on a different level and observe on a different level. If I really want to get to where I want to go, I have to be so respectful and try to understand what's happening here. What, you know, there's a second story that I'm not understanding that's making this person either reticent or overly excited or frightened or angry. That's a skill you develop, I think, when you're working internationally.
I wonder if not having language actually forces you to be more sensitive.
Absolutely.
To what you can see.
Absolutely. In fact, as a very young photographer, I learned that interpreters very much got in the way of me connecting with the people themselves because you're talking, it's like you're talking to a wall and then you smile stupidly while the wall talks to the other. Whereas if you look at each other and are comfortable being an idiot, it's wonderful. I mean, it's disarming. And as we all know, when someone comes from another country and tries their best to talk to us, you immediately kind of feel like you want to take care of them. And you laugh more easily and they laugh. And it's, you know, it breaks down the walls very quickly.
Do you have a different relationship to the pictures you take of people in these very remote places where you've spent hours or even days with them and taking these great pictures, and then you take them back and you put them into a spread that's going to be in the magazine or somewhere else, knowing that these images will live forever and they will probably never lay eyes on them?
Oh, that's an interesting question also. Sometimes, yeah, I try to get pictures back to people, especially, you know, I'm with so many people, but there are certain people, as there are in all of our careers, who just knock themselves out or who you really develop a relationship with or who give extraordinary amounts of time or are generous, you know, like feed you. And yeah, you want to give something back to them. And often you can find a way to do it. Sometimes you absolutely cannot.
So. We have an email here from Susie who wants to know what you think about the future of the career of photography, since everyone could be a photojournalist with their cell phone. I'm not sure whether you agree with that statement or not, but is there opportunity for young people considering the field?
It's a great question. Publishing is under tremendous pressure now. There are no longer jobs where there used to be jobs. But I think the appetite for imagery is growing by leaps and bounds. I don't know exactly which path it will take, but there's no doubt in my mind that people want more and better photographs. I'm not at all threatened by the fact that anybody can take a picture because that's always sort of been true. It is. I'm thrilled that more people can enjoy photography without the financial burden of each roll of film. You know, I remember when my kids were little, and after the 15th picture of the rock, I was thinking, you know, now, Charlie, we may have enough of that rock. And because it was, you know, 50 cents a pop.
Right, so, yeah. Whether it's terrible or wonderful.
Right, you know, and so I think there's a nice creative freedom. But there will be, there are jobs and there will be jobs. And I think right now for a young photographer, I would say really think about digital capture. Think about the combining of still and video photography, because I think it's coming like a freight train. I'm not happy about it, but
you don't do video.
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. And so, but I do think that it's going to offer opportunities for lots of young, talented people, and who, especially who are really far more technical than my generation ever was, and is with computers and all of the digital editing and all of that. So there will always be photo jobs.
It does seem that, you know, lots of people are lamenting the transition of some of the publishing industry to digital forms. But
sure,
boy, photographs look especially beautiful on a tablet computer or an iPad or whatever
they
people
can
might have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can. But I remember this. I'm aging myself here, but I remember being in the newsroom when they carted the typewriters out and brought in the first computers, and I saw the panic on all the writers' faces, and they
was when you could still smoke in the newsroom.
Yes,
too,
oh, absolutely. But I remember that, and as we were making this painful transfer from film to digital, I remembered that well, and I remembered how grateful, you know, a year or two later, how grateful most of the writers were for that transition. And I must say, as much as I miss film, and digital is really, really, really good, but it's not Kodachrome. I am grateful for it on a daily basis, because it allows me to move images to people. And, you know, it just, I used to have to pull slides and make duplicates and, you know, schlep them to FedEx. And, you know, those days have passed. So there is a flow that's nice. But there are aspects of it also that drive me absolutely crazy. And I dread the next generation of still capture.
Can you be casual about snapshots of somebody's birthday?
Not so much. It's a problem. You know, it's so funny, because I really, and my whole family is accustomed to it now, but I don't even think to bring a camera to family events and I think initially it was sort of like, well, I don't expect my Uncle George to bring his stethoscope. And, you know, I felt conspicuous. But it was also because my kids, you know, from an early age saw the camera as me working. So when I was with them, I put it down.
Annie Griffiths is a photographer. She has worked around the world for National Geographic and other publications. She's in town to speak tonight at the Brinker International Forum at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. Annie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.